it's...
Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, May 29th, 2023. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. All about sewer lines. What does Cedar Rapids do to keep lines clear? Without regular maintenance, blockages from soda bottles and tree roots can cause backups into homes and streets. This is by Bailey Ciccone. Most people don't think about what they send down the drain until a sink or toilet clogs, but the Cedar Rapids Sewer Maintenance Team is always thinking about that and working to keep pipes clear. Curious Iowa is a new series from the Gazette that seeks to answer your questions about the state, its culture, and the people who live there. One curious Iowan wondered, what are the huge trucks parked on some Cedar Rapids streets, and why are they dropping lines into the sewers? We set out to find the answer, which includes a small, tank-like vehicle that's operated with a video game controller. Backups can happen at any point in water's journey to a wastewater treatment plant. Serious blockages can clog sewer lines, flooding waste into homes and streets. Those backups can be avoided with regular maintenance from dedicated city employees who don't mind getting a little dirty. How do sewer lines work? When water flows down a drain, it begins a journey through 1,300 miles of sewer lines beneath the Cedar Rapids to the wastewater treatment plant. These lines can be as small as 6 inches in diameter and as large as 48 inches. Residential and industrial waste, the things you flush down the toilet or wash down the kitchen sink, runs into the sanitary sewer lines. Storm sewer lines transport whatever flows off roads. Sometimes tree roots, litter, and animals find their way into storm sewer lines, although there are no heroic genetically mutated turtles fighting crime below Cedar Rapids. The real heroes are the Cedar Rapids Sewer Maintenance Team members who work to clear debris from lines when clogged. A look under Cedar Rapids. Sewer maintenance is conducted daily around the city with specialized equipment that includes camera and jetter trucks. The camera truck provides a look into the sewer lines. A small tank-like vehicle outfitted with a camera and LED lights is lowered into the sewer line, where it crawls through pipes. The truck receives a live feed from the camera, where an operator notes any issues. Carrie Brown is a lead televising equipment operator with the City of Cedar Rapids. He guides the camera through the sewer line using an old Xbox controller. In front of him, one monitor televises the camera feed. On the other, he logs what he sees. We're looking for roots or grease, anything that is going to make that pipe weak and collapse and back up into someone's houses, Brown said. And if we can stop that before that happens, well, then everybody wins. Meanwhile, a jetter truck is stationed on the other end of the line, awaiting instructions. When a clog is discovered, like a Mountain Dew bottle that was wedged in the sewer line on the day the Gazette visited, the team uses the jetter truck to send high-pressure water through the sewer line. The camera remains in the pipe, but is pulled away from the clog while the jetter works. Jetter hoses rely on different head attachments depending on what is stuck inside sewer lines. The heads can range from a claw shape to a bucket. City employees on the jetter truck end of things work by feel and rely on communication from the camera truck to clear blockages. Sewer maintenance supervisor Mike Levin said the city has been using jetter trucks for more than 25 years. They originally started with little pump trucks, and then they've started adding vacuum systems to them, which, again, suck up all the debris in the storm sewers, Levin said. In the case of the soda bottle, the jetter truck works on the opposite end of the sewer line from the camera truck. A long hose is snaked through the line to direct high-pressure water at the blockage. After a few tries, the jetter truck successfully blasted the bottle out of place. In some cases, the sewer team needs to cut through debris like tree roots to clear roots. The team uses a rotter truck, which is similar to the jetter truck, except instead of water, it uses mechanical power and blades to get the job done. Roots will find smallest cracks. They come through tape. They come through the connections around the taps and through cracks in the pipe. The drier it gets, somehow the roots know where that water is, and they'll find it, Brown said. We've come across places where this whole 8-inch line will just be blocked off with roots. The city uses a detailed system to monitor all storm and sanitary sewer lines. Every 10 years, a full cycle of cleaning each sewer is completed, Levin said. Who does this dirty job? Derek Neunemaker has worked as a sewer maintenance laborer for 4 years. Neunemaker studied mechanical engineering at Iowa State. I mean, I'm not doing what I went to school for, but I'm enjoying it every day, kind of helping the public out and just giving back, Neunemaker said. As one would expect, sewer maintenance work is dirty and smelly at times. For the most part, it's pretty mild, but you definitely run into a lot of stuff that's unpleasant, Neunemaker said. Despite this, Neunemaker likes his job and the camaraderie of the sewer maintenance team. You got to have a good sense of humor in this line of work. It makes the day more enjoyable. You can't be straight as an arrow all day. What can you do to keep lines flowing? Levin says clogs can be prevented. Keep leaves off the street, Levin says. Throw your pop bottles away. That's the number one plugging up issue that we have is pop bottles. Hubcaps is another one. Okay, our next story. Cedar Rapids, Lynn, look to the future of trails and bikeways. Public invited to share ideas on trail network. This is by Marissa Payne. Tom Peffer recalls the days in the early 2000s when Lynn County bicyclists basically had a couple of gravel trails and then had to ride on streets that had little space reserved for them and their wheels. But great strides have been made in the past 20 years, said Peffer, president of the nonprofit Lynn County Trails Association. Lynn County, Cedar Rapids, and Marion now have a little more than 100 miles of hard surface trails, with planners looking to connect existing trails and add more communities to the trails network. It's just amazing how much progress we've made, Peffer said. We have to fill in the gaps, or it really isn't a system that flows like it should. To guide that future work, the City of Cedar Rapids and Lynn County Conservation are working on a trails and bikeways plan, and they're asking the public, local businesses, and trail and bikeway enthusiasts to think about the future and what they'd like to see. The plan will update the city's and county's existing trail plans and maps. The city's plan was adopted in 2012, and the county's was adopted about 20 years ago. Trails and bikeways, local leaders believe, help recruit and retain workers, boost the quality of life, draw tourists to the area, and attract new businesses. During Bike to Work Week last month, Cedar Rapids staffers shared information and listened to ideas at several events, such as a handlebar happy hour at the Sag Wagon, a gathering spot for food and drinks along the trail around Cedar Lake. Using that input, a plan will be drafted in the coming months and shared with the public for more feedback in the fall, Senior Cedar Rapids Traffic Engineer Ron Griffith said. The updated plan is expected to come to the City Council for consideration by December. Madison, Wisconsin-based Tool Design Group and Snyder & Associates are working with the city on the plan, and a new trails map will identify locations of planned trails and of amenities such as restrooms, water stations, public art, and fitness stations. Trails cross municipal boundaries, and so we're working with Lynn County to make sure that the jurisdictions outside of Cedar Rapids can come in and enjoy everything we have to offer, or allowing Cedar Rapidians to go out and explore, City Planner Haley Sevening said. Expanding in the county. In addition to enhancing trail connections to Cedar Rapids, Lynn County conservation officials said their main goal is to better connect smaller communities to the trail system and to county parks. We want to make sure that everybody in the county, whether it be within the larger population areas or some of the rural areas, has access to these opportunities, including an accessible trail system, said Ryan Schlatter, County Conservation Community Outreach Specialist. Randy Burke, an outdoor recreation planner for Lynn County Conservation, said trail connections are needed in communities such as Springville, Fairfax, Palo, Centerpoint, and Central City. Work on the Grant Wood Trail, located off Highway 13 near Marion's Waldo's Rock Park, is a key opportunity for the county to expand the trail to the east of the Cedar Rapids metro area, potentially into Benton County, Burke said. These are parts of the plan that we have looked at over the last 20 years, and we just need to update a plan so that everybody can see what the future is looking at, Burke said. We're talking things that could be 20, 25, 30 years out yet, because it takes a long time to develop these trails. Adding trail connections also would better connect communities to the spine of the 52-mile Cedar Valley Nature Trail. The trail, managed jointly by the Blackhawk County and Lynn County Conservation Boards, spans four counties, meandering south from Waterloo and LaPorte City into the Cedar Rapids metro area. The trail was opened in the 1980s, but Lynn County Conservation Executive Director Dennis GOMAT, said it's taken four decades to truly complete it and hard surface most of its length. Work on the remaining gravel surface will be completed in the coming years, with support from a federally funded Destination Iowa state grant awarded to the Linn and Black Hawk County Conservation Boards. The county also is working on the Morgan Creek Trail, going from Morgan Creek Park and following Highway 100 to near Xavier High School. From there, bicyclists can use bike lanes on 42nd Street Northeast to the Cedar Valley Nature Trail. Once the Connect CR project is completed, it will revitalize Cedar Lake and add a pedestrian bike bridge over the Cedar River between Nubo and Czech Village. That loop will be extended and become a destination, GOMAT said. All these loops, the extra connections that you make, just make it more enticing for people to come and spend time here, GOMAT said. CMAR Cherokee. The Corridor Metropolitan Planning Organization also has boosted support for trails, and now 85% of the funding it receives goes toward trail development, according to Griffith, the Cedar Rapids traffic engineer. That has helped projects such as the CMAR Trail, which connects downtown Cedar Rapids to uptown Marion. Griffith said the next phase would have the trail going from Council Street to the Cedar Valley Nature Trail, while Marion is working to connect it to the Grant Wood Trail. Another project underway, the Cherokee Trail, will connect Cherry Hill Park in southwest Cedar Rapids to the county's Morgan Creek Park. Eventually, the trail will go from Edgewood Road into downtown Cedar Rapids. Planning the future. Since its last trails plan was adopted in 2012, Cedar Rapids has doubled the miles of trails and added more than 50 miles of new on-street bikeways. The updated plan needs to be synced with other city master plans on flood control, climate action, and access for those with disabilities, according to Sevening, the Cedar Rapids city planner. In street projects, too, she said, the city looks to incorporate trails and bikeways, looking for opportunities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by encouraging bike use and walking. The work strengthens neighborhood connections and also connections to the surrounding area, Sevening and Griffith said. Not everybody has the luxury of having access to a car to get to where they want to go. People want the choice of being able to either take a car or take a bike, walk, or where they want to go to, Griffith said. Okay, now we have a Memorial Day article. Veteran's death is a cautionary tale about homelessness. Roger Starr shone light on increased visibility of Cedar Rapids homelessness. This is by Elijah Desius. Out of Cedar Rapids, last Thanksgiving, as Maxine Prime tended to people she always helped at Willis Dady Homeless Services, one of her clients gave her a piece of advice. She was feeling sick, but still was helping others before herself. Her homeless client, Roger Starr, told her to go home and recover. That if she didn't take care of herself first, others like him would die from a lack of her care. For more than 7 months, Roger camped out near the Willis Dady shelter, but refused to go inside. The day after Thanksgiving, after months of unsuccessful attempts to bring him in for shelter or to connect him to services, Willis Dady staff finally persuaded him to come inside. And that day, after living homeless intermittently for several years and unsheltered for most of 2022, Roger died at age 66. His last breath was in a shelter, and that hurts, said Shannon Fay, a veteran housing case manager for Willis Dady. Last year, 30 people like Roger died while living unsheltered in the streets of Linn County. Six of them were veterans. So far this year, six more have died. Two of them were veterans. Roger's story. Though Roger's situation, dying homeless in Cedar Rapids, was not unique, his story illustrates a tension homeless advocates have faced as the local homeless population continues to grow with no new solutions and no end in sight. Roger's difficulty with housing started several years ago when he became estranged from his wife and started living at the Roadway Inn in southwest Cedar Rapids. After serving his country during the Vietnam War, retiring from a career as an iron worker in the Chicago area, and moving to Iowa with his wife, he found himself in the same situation as more than 100 others in the community last year, homeless. He was housed once through homeless services for veterans when he got a place at a Northwest Cedar Rapids apartment complex for 10 months. By May 2022, the apartment was scheduled for forcible entry and repossession. With no evident relationship with his estranged wife, two stepsons, or family, Roger probably lost that apartment because he spent too much of his monthly pension on others, say advocates who knew Roger best. He had a little more monthly income than the average client, but most of his cash was gone by the fifth day of each month. Aaron Taronis, support services director for Willis Dady, got to know him through their drives to the bank every payday. During those rides, Roger's dreams varied. Some days, Rogers would talk about saving enough to buy a vehicle to travel out of state. Other times, he would talk about buying a house across the street from Willis Dady to share with other homeless friends. But all of his plans had one condition: helping others also experiencing homelessness, not just himself. In the last 7 months of Roger's life, he was cited with trespassing 4 times. In October, he was arrested for it. Almost every trespassing citation lists the same place: the Willis Dady Men's Shelter at 1247 4th Avenue Southeast, or the area near it. Neighbors see Roger and say, "That's an eyesore. I think that's what the problem is," said Faye. "We need to change a lot of people's outlooks on what it's really like, because it could be any one of us at any time." Roger helped others before himself. Roger refused to accept help no matter how many times it was offered. "I've got to take care of my people," he said with each refusal, referring to the homeless community he had grown close to through his own journey. Described as gruff, stubborn, and fiercely protective of those he cared about, Roger protected others from those who preyed on the homeless and their meager monthly income. With no blood family to live with, they were his family. In a mentality he couldn't shed after his honorable discharge from the U.S. Navy in 1977, he refused to leave anyone behind. The day after Thanksgiving, his death was the only thing that could force him to leave everyone behind. He really wanted there to be some changes that occurred with other people on the street experiencing homelessness, said Denise Rushing, shelter services director for Willis Dady. Roger knew that if he got with the Veterans Affairs Services, they'd get him off the streets, and he could do that at any time. But he also knew that the people he was sleeping outside with didn't have that option. The challenges of going to a shelter, be they addictions, mental health issues, or a mind frame that says others need the help more, made it a non-viable choice for Roger, as it has for others. But unlike others who go to great lengths to stay out of sight, Roger slept in one of the most visible places, near the shelter itself. In a world where the housed want to dictate what homelessness should look like, where it can be contained and determined how the homeless should receive help, Roger refused to be moved along with each neighbor's complaint. His stubbornness highlighted a truth that advocates have been saying for years. There's only so many times you can shuffle around the homeless population before there are no more places to hide. The majority of Cedar Rapids' unsheltered homeless population are single men. Once the Willis Dady Men's Shelter is full, there are no other options in Linn County. There was a bigger message than Roger even realized. He made homelessness visible, Rushing said. Roger was spreading a message without even knowing it. Veterans struggle disproportionately. In the United States, only 7% of the population are veterans. But among the homeless, veterans account for 13% of the population, according to the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans. Last year in Linn County, 20% of the homeless people who died were veterans. So far this year, 1/3 of the homeless people who have died were veterans. Roger chose to serve his country. He didn't choose to serve with all the consequences that come with that, said Taronis, a veteran himself. Homeless veteran caseworkers and specialists say that mental illness after service, especially PTSD, affects many of their clients. Going hand in hand with untreated mental illness, self-medication leads to addictions that can make situations even more complicated to resolve. Faye said many veterans experiencing challenges receiving care from the Veterans Affairs health care system. And for veterans who need it, accepting help is easier said than done. It often takes them to be very, very desperate to accept help, said John Green, outreach worker for HACAP's homeless veteran clients. A lot of them continue to come back time and time again. In a culture of self-reliance among veterans, neglecting the resources available to them is common. In helping veterans, Green has found many who have never tapped into their VA benefits or aren't aware of all the resources available exclusively for them. As with many veterans' honors, homeless vets tell themselves they're undeserving of the benefits or that others deserve them more. "I'll be all right, baby," is something that Prime can still hear Rogers say in her head. Veteran specialists say that, overall, the homeless veteran population in eastern Iowa is covered well in terms of the number of caseworkers. It's often other issues in the course of case management that complicate problem solving. Many veterans' issues overlap with the same challenges for those who never served. Finding landlords willing to take homeless clients is a barrier in itself, said HACAP case manager Sarah Reagan. Even for those receiving VA pensions and benefits, a lack of budgeting skills after they get into housing can exacerbate a precarious relationship. Roger's last eviction in May 2022 was prompted by 1 month of missed rent, $525. And when they get housed, it's often to an empty or nearly empty home with few avenues for securing affordable furniture. Often we're stuck putting people in substandard housing, said Reagan. It doesn't work out, so that's part of the cycle, people coming in and out because there's no other choice in places. When other personnel factors snowball into a life of living outside, the discrimination homeless people face from passersby, neighbors, and business owners leads to internalized shame that further lowers their self-esteem. When people tell you that you're disgusting and dirty, that they don't want you in their business, it affects their self-esteem, Green said. It's so defeating when every day you're told you're worthless. For some veterans, it's a message they started hearing about themselves even before they became homeless. For those who came to love Roger, accepting him as he was delivered a new lesson to advocates who work with some of the city's most vulnerable people. The main thing I learned is that we have to accept homelessness in whatever form it comes in. We can't dictate what it looks like, said Rushing, who has been with Willis Dady for 17 years. Roger had gotten to the point where he was tired of following along to the beat of other people's drums. He wanted to live life on his own terms. And so the homeless veteran left this earth the same way he lived, on his own terms. Our next article is entitled Lynn Resiliency Hub to Unify Disaster Responses and Support. Cedar Rapids Hub is a model for an expanding network across the county. This is by Brittany J. Miller out of Cedar Rapids. After the unprecedented 2020 derecho tore through Iowa, Lynn County organizations tried to offer help and care services, but the post-disaster disarray created communication barriers that made their resources less efficient. Less than a year later, in June 2021, the county's first resiliency hub was created in Cedar Rapids. It will serve as the local nexus for emergency resources and services during times of disaster. Otherwise, it's a year-round space that provides three critical resources to the surrounding community: access to food, access to energy, and access to information. Going forward, it will serve as a model for new resiliency hubs as the network expands across Lynn County. The web of resources will help organizations better communicate with each other, join forces, and avoid replicating their efforts to serve communities in need. It's important to be really mindful of what you already have available and how to use it, said Tamara Marcus, Lynn County's sustainability director. It's identifying what we already have in our community, both in terms of physical infrastructure and also our social networks, and figuring out how to responsibly open these up to more people. Cedar Rapids Resiliency Hub grows. The existing Resiliency Hub sits beside the Fillmore Center at 520 11th Street Northwest in Cedar Rapids. The area was once just an empty field of grass, unused and lacking purpose. Now it's going into its third year of management by Lynn County's Sustainability Department. The less than an acre lot is full of garden beds and compost. The space also has hosted rain barrel distributions. Its gardening is continuing to expand as new collaborators join the project. Currently, Feed Iowa First and its Equitable Land Access program partner with Lynn County Sustainability Department for maintaining the gardens. The Academy for Scholastic and Personal Success offers culturally relevant gardening classes on-site for people of color. The harvested produce is donated to Feed Iowa First, its Equitable Land Access program network, and local food banks. A pergola and an agrivoltaic pilot project may be added to the area. Agrivoltaics are the emerging practice of putting solar panels on top of active crops or gardens. In this case, the created solar energy would offset the energy used by the air quality monitoring station, which will hopefully provide public Wi-Fi soon. Many of these additions will depend on decisions from the Lynn County Board of Supervisors. In the future, we really hope to sort of make this a hub of events and use this green space as well as the gardens, said Ayla Boylan, the volunteer site ambassador for the Cedar Rapids Hub. A model for change. The Cedar Rapids Resiliency Hub will serve as a model for other sites in the works across the county. The hubs will be personalized to the communities they're housed in, low-income communities and those with larger populations of people of color have been prioritized. The network of hubs will work with a variety of organizations and combine their resources instead of potentially replicating efforts, especially during times of disaster. Having those resources organized and spread across the county will improve access for more residents. Replicating this as many times as you can so that you don't have to travel very far in a time of crisis is really the end goal, Boylan said. The new hubs won't look the same, though. For example, the next one to open will be the Wellington Heights Community Church, an internal hub within a structure, unlike the open green space of the existing Cedar Rapids hub. It will also have a community fridge that's open 24/7. The idea is that you create a site that allows neighborhoods to have a place to go where they can get resources when you have shared disasters, Marcus said. But sometimes disasters aren't shared, right? You could be experiencing a personal disaster. Having opportunities for people to be the determinant of what they need is important. Shaping the growth. The county's recently approved resiliency coordinator position will be instrumental in coordinating the resiliency hubs and organizing disaster preparedness plans once hired. That person also will apply for grants and other funding sources for the projects to make them more sustainable in the long term. As more sites are added, they will eventually all be featured on a digital dashboard that maps resiliency hubs across the county. And now we're going to go to the insight section, the opinions, and read a guest column from, guest column entitled Honoring Vets Lost to Addiction and Suicide. Substance abuse and mental health disorders and suicide ideation are significant problems among the veteran population. This Memorial Day, millions of American families will take time to honor the men and women who lost their lives in service of their country. While doing this, we also must remember the countless veterans who lost their battle with addiction or mental health. The harsh reality is that substance disorders in veteran populations are a significant factor in homelessness and suicide. In Iowa, there are over 180,000 veterans, and 18% served after September 11, 2001, while 36% served during the Vietnam War. I'm going to start that paragraph over. I'm really sorry. In Iowa, there are over 180,000 veterans, and 18% served after September 11, 2001, while 36% served during the Vietnam War era. According to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, over 3.9 million veterans nationally have a substance use disorder or mental illness. Substance use disorders significantly increased suicidality among veterans. There are different reasons why veterans become addicted to drugs or alcohol. Countless veterans struggle to adjust to civilian life, face financial hardship, and have difficulty finding employment and accessing benefits. Mental and emotional health concerns create struggles within family relationships. Substance use can become a way of coping with difficult or unwanted thoughts and feelings. Untreated trauma affects every aspect of life and can easily develop into mental health or substance use disorders. In addition, there are barriers to accessing treatment, such as cost and insurance gaps. Many communities struggle with inadequate funding and limited access to treatment options in rural locations. Stigma regarding addiction and mental health is still problematic. Fortunately, there are resources and ways families and communities can help. Consider the following. The Iowa Department of Veterans Affairs provides resources and support options. Helpful hotlines include the Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-8255, and Lifeline for Vets, 1-888-777-4443. SAMHSA provides a facility treatment locator where veterans can find specific help. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has a VA facility locator and resources for veterans who are homeless. Families can use VA benefits in combination with other forms of health insurance such as Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance to reduce costs. It's okay to speak to them openly and honestly about their substance abuse and express concern without judgment. Help them find treatment and be patient and compassionate for what they are experiencing. communities can work to advocate for more support and funding. They also can advocate to decrease the number of opioid and benzodiazepine prescriptions given to veterans and explore alternative forms of therapy. Memorial Day is about honoring those men and women who lost their lives in service of the U.S. military. We also must continue to support those men and women who made it home but are struggling with internal battles, provide support, and come together as a community. And this guest columnist was Veronica Rawson. She's a community outreach coordinator for Addicted.org and is passionate about spreading awareness of the risks and dangers of alcohol and drug use. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Jeremy S. Appleton, 73, of Fairfax, died Monday, May 8th at Westridge Care Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The family will greet guests from 9 to 11 a.m. June 2nd at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service with military honors will immediately follow at 11 a.m. at the funeral home. A reception in Jerry's honor will follow at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood. Interment is at 2:30 p.m. June 2nd at the Westview Cemetery in LaPorte City. William Bill Eugene Doherty, 89, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, May 27th at St. Luke's Hospice Center of Cedar Rapids. Services are 1:30 p.m. Thursday at Tehan Funeral Home by Brian Reeves. Burial will be at the Czech National Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family on Wednesday from 4 to 7 p.m. at Tehan Funeral Home. Bill is survived by his wife of nearly 70 years, Betty, his daughters Brenda Harrington and Kelly Schmidt, both of Cedar Rapids, grandchildren Jennifer Whitted of Polk City and Jessica Harrington, Daniel Schmidt and Bradley Schmidt, all of Cedar Rapids, great-grandchildren Caitlin and Meredith Whitted, and his dear Scotty Baxter. He was preceded in death by his sister Patricia Kiltz and brother Richard Doherty. Bill was born on August 19, 1993, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Charles and Dorothy Cozart Doherty. He graduated from Roosevelt High School and served in the U.S. Navy Reserves. Bill was the owner of Brad's Marine until 1979, Baron Motors as a salesman for many years. After retirement, he spent his spare time at Wendy's on Blair's Ferry Road, greeting all at the drive-through window where he made many friends. Bill loved working at his marina. He also liked gardening and working around his pond. Bill also enjoyed the Friday night races. Most of all, Bill loved his grandkids and great-grandkids and having family time. He will be missed by his friends and family. Harlan Dean Cronbaugh, 83, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Belle Plaine, passed away May 25th at St. Luke's Hospital. Harlan was born St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Harlan was born June 27, 1939, to Harley and Edith Slaymaker Cronbaugh in Belle Plaine. Growing up on the family farm, he attended country school until 8th grade and graduated from Belle Plaine High School. Following school, he worked at Amana Refrigeration before his career as a petroleum department manager at Farmers Four County Co-op. On Valentine's Day 1960, Harlan married his high school sweetheart, Sandra Kenner, at First Lutheran Church, Belle Plaine. The couple raised their children in the Belle Plaine area, living in town before moving to the Cronbaugh family farm. Harlan worked at the co-op during the day and farmed at night. Eventually, the couple moved back to town before most recently moving to Cedar Rapids. Harlan loved woodworking and golf. He was an avid Iowa Hawkeyes fan, enjoying basketball and football season tickets. Together, the couple loved to travel and would leave at the drop of a hat with no plans. Most of all, he cherished his grandchildren, catching many moments on the video recorder and always there to cheer them on at activities. He's survived by his wife, Sandy, of Cedar Rapids, sons Bill Cronbaugh of Iowa City and Bob Cronbaugh of Iowa City and Bill Cronbaugh of Centerpoint, grandchildren Taylor, Logan, Jordan, Aaron, and Ryan, sister Marcia Humphrey of Cedar Rapids, brother Dennis Cronbaugh of Belle Plaine, and sister-in-law Judy Kenner of Chelsea. Harlan was preceded in death by his parents and brother-in-law Kenny Kenner. Visitation is from 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, June 1st, with a time for sharing at 6 p.m. at Harbach Newhouse Funeral Service, Belle Plaine. Private family burial will take place at Oak Hill Cemetery in Belle Plaine. Gerald T. Sheriff, Jerry, 80, of Cedar Rapids, died unexpectedly on Thursday, May 18th, surrounded by his family. Jerry was the beloved husband of Lois Jean Sheriff. They shared 40 years of marriage together. Jerry was born in Lansing, Iowa, on December 11, 1942, the son of Jasper David Sheriff and Clara Veronica Sheriff. Jerry was predeceased by his parents and his half-siblings Jerry Rossi, Dorothy Rossi, Robert Rossi, and Paul Rossi. Jerry is survived by his wife Lois, his stepdaughters Jean Finley and Patty Cramblatt, his son-in-law Jerry Cramblatt, his three grandchildren, Brian, Connor, and Bailey, and his two great-grandchildren. Jerry served in the U.S. Army from 1961 to 1970 as a cook and baker. He attended Cook and Baker School in 1961 and received an honorable discharge from the Army in 1970. Jerry met his wife Lois while working as a gas station manager in Cedar Rapids. Jerry then served as first cook for Bishop's Buffet in Westdale Mall from 1989 until Bishop's closed in 1997. From 1997 until his retirement in 2014, Jerry worked as a cook in the Johnson County Jail. In his well-deserved retirement, Jerry enjoyed tending to his lawn and garden, spending time with his family, and caring for his cherished wife. He will be remembered as a patient, kind, very funny man, and devoted father and husband. A celebration of life will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, July 1st, at the Indian Creek Nature Center in Cedar Rapids. Bruce G. Taylor, 67, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, May 25th, at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha, surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom on Friday, June 2nd, from 2 p.m. until service time at 3 p.m., with Pastor Craig Brown officiating. Interment to follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery Garden of Tranquility. Bruce was born on February 16, 1956, in Cedar Rapids. He was the son of Mildred Maxine and the late Paul Randall Taylor. Those left to cherish Bruce's memory are his mother, Mildred of Cedar Rapids, his brothers Christopher, Craig, and Marshall Taylor, all of Cedar Rapids, and his nieces and nephews, Lincoln, London, Xavier, Mason, Shelyn, Maris, and Maurice. He was preceded in death by his father, Paul Taylor. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family. Richard J. Bating, 98, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, May 22nd. Funeral service is at 11 a.m. Saturday, June 3rd, at Tehan Funeral Home by Dr. Jim Coyle. Burial will be at St. John's Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family before the service from 9 to 11 a.m. at Tehan Funeral Home. Adventurer, patriot, husband, father, and superb friend, Richard was born on December 13, 1924, in Castle Grove, the son of Joseph and Stasia Hogan Bating. He was a proud Army veteran serving during World War II, part of General Patton's Red Ball Express, and he was present during the Battle of the Bulge. He was awarded 4 Bronze Stars and the Belgian Fourragerie. On July 27, 1949, he married Mimi Cutts, in Cedar Rapids. Richard satisfied his love of the open road as a long-haul truck driver for 35 years, retiring in 1983. After his retirement, he pursued another dream and launched the Bating Engine Service until 1993. Richard was a member of Teamsters 238. Richard was a mechanic who loved fixing problems others couldn't solve. He mastered everything he set his mind to, including ballroom dancing. He loved family time and will be missed. Richard is survived by his son, Thomas Bating of Volga, daughter, Mary Bating of Carmel, California, grandchildren, Cameron Bating, Jeremiah Bating, and Blade Christian, and great-grandchildren, Caitlin, Claire, and Nathan. Richard was preceded in death by his spouse of nearly 44 years, Mimi. May they be reunited in peace and in love. Jerry J. Thorius, 76, Colonel, retired in the U.S. from the U.S. Air Force of Amana, passed away Friday, May 26th. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, May 31st, at First Presbyterian Church in Iowa City. Jerry was born in Primgar, Iowa, to Donald and Norma Thorius on October 28th, 1946. Jerry married Maylene Tompkins in 1968. at the First Presbyterian Church in Marנגו. He graduated from the University of Iowa in 1969 with a degree in chemical engineering. Upon graduation, Jerry was commissioned a second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force. He graduated from pilot training in 1970 and was selected for fighter aircraft. He spent his career flying fighters and doing the associated staff assignments that went with fighter aircraft. Jerry and Maylene spent time in Germany as well as numerous assignments in stateside locations. He is survived by his wife of 54 years, Maylene, his daughter, Laura, of Iowa City, his son, John, of Cave Creek, Arizona, his granddaughters, Alex, Rachel Marsh, and May Thorius, his brother, Jim, and wife, Julia, and numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his parents, his grandparents, John and Rose Thorius, and John and Tina Rickers, and numerous friends from the flying community. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to Tunnels to Towers or First Presbyterian Church. Kloster Funeral Home of Marengo is assisting the family with arrangements. Shirley K. Cook Rodert, 77, of Marion, passed away on Friday, May 26th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 31st at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, where a vigil service will begin at 4:15 p.m., followed by a rosary. Mass of Christian burial will begin at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, June 1st, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, with Father David O'Connor officiating. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Shirley was born on August 14, 1945, in Bell Gardens, California, the daughter of Leonard and Alice Wieland Cook. She was a 1963 graduate of Mingo High School in Mingo. On September 3, 1966, Shirley was united in marriage to Vernon Rodert in Colfax. For 21 years, she owned and operated Soigner Body Therapy in Marion until her retirement in 2007. Shirley was a longtime member of St. Joseph Catholic Church. She loved to crochet. She will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Shirley is survived and lovingly remembered by her husband of 56 years, Vernon, three daughters, Cheryl Wynn, Sheila Brody, and Sharon Westman, sisters Theresia Gustafson, Lenora Kernan, Charlotte Culberson, and Renee Tesdall, grandchildren Nicole Wynn Ebel, Chantel Wynn Phillips, Ryan Wynn, Brittany Rodert, Anthony Westman, Stacy Westman, and Angela Westman, five great-grandchildren and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, sister Rosemary Hulse, and nephew David Gustafson. Okay, I'm going to go to the sports section. College baseball. Maryland outslugs Iowa for B1G title. This is by Jeff Johnson. They're still in the NCAA tournament, don't worry too much about that. The Iowa Hawkeyes would have had a 100% fully guaranteed spot in college baseball's version of the Big Dance with a win in Sunday afternoon's Big Ten Conference Baseball Tournament Championship game at Charles Schwab Field in Omaha, Nebraska. But a 4-0 loss to top-seeded Maryland made them officially an at-large berths candidate. A strong at-large candidate with a RPI of somewhere around the high 20s or low 30s when it's all said and done. In other words, they should be in really good shape. Iowa, whose record is 42-14, will find out its regional assignment today. I think being in the environment that we were in today will make next week much more normal for our guys, regardless of the outcome today, Iowa coach Rick Heller said. It was super beneficial to have the awesome crowd that came out for us. It put our guys in a different situation than what they are normally in, and any time you are put in a situation like that, it's a positive, and it's going to help us grow. An offense that has been oh so productive down the stretch was impotent Sunday. The Hawkeyes were shut out for just the third time this season, the first time since a 2-0, 10-inning loss April 8th at Indiana. They grounded into three double plays, including a round-the-horn one that ended things. Both teams bullpened this game, with Maryland, whose record is 41-19, using five pitchers, who limited Iowa to five hits. The Hawkeyes left two on in both the first and second innings and a runner in scoring position in the third, but never seriously threatened to score thereafter. "We had a lot of missed opportunities early in the game," Heller said. "We needed to do some damage against Maryland starting pitcher Ryan Van Buren and reliever Andrew Johnson when we had runners in scoring position. But we hit a few line drives." Let me find the next part. "Right at the right fielder. Maryland didn't do a whole lot more offensively, but had the long ball going for it. After a leadoff walk in the fifth, Kevin Keister hit a two-run home run to left field. Two batters later, Nick LaRusso hit a solo shot to left, his 23rd home run this season and 99th RBI. Jacob Orr's run-scoring single in the sixth made it a 4-0 game. Maryland was the Big Ten's best offensive team this season. The Terrapins won the Big Ten regular season, tying with Indiana for first, and claimed its first Big Ten tournament title. Iowa started Marcus Morgan on the mound Sunday, though he went just two innings because he was working on short rest, 4 days instead of the normal 7 for college pitchers, and so he can be available this coming week for regionals. Jack Whitlock, whose record is 7-1, who has been great all season, allowed the 3 fifth-inning runs and took the loss. Luke Llewellyn, another very effective Hawkeyes reliever this season, gave up the run in the sixth. Iowa lost for just the fifth time in 24 games. This was its first appearance in the Big Ten Tournament Championship game since 2017. 42 is the most wins under Heller. The all-time school record for victories is 44 in 1981. That's a mark that the Hawkeyes should have a chance at. And I'm going to read a story on auto racing. New Garden does it. Final lap pass delivers 19th Indianapolis 500 win for Penske. Out of Indianapolis, Joseph Newgarden ended 11 years of frustration and finally won the Indianapolis 500 on Sunday to extend team owner Roger Penske's record to 19 victories, but first since buying Indianapolis Motor Speedway, using an audacious pass of defending race winner Marcus Ericsson during a frantic 2.5-mile sprint to the finish. After the race was red-flagged for the third time in the final 16 laps, Newgarden was moved from fourth to second by race control following a review of the running order at the time the yellow flag waved. The two-time IndyCar champion, who had been 0-11 in the greatest spectacle in racing, took advantage of his improved position by slingshotting around Ericsson on the restart and holding him off through the last two turns. Newgarden brought his Chevrolet-powered car to a stop on the front stretch, jumped out, and found a hole in the fence, diving into part of a crowd estimated at more than 300,000 to celebrate. Then Newgarden climbed the fence to mimic longtime Team Penske driver and four-time Indy 500 winner Helio Castroneves. The 32-year-old from Nashville is the first American to win Indy since Alexander Rossi in 2016. "I'm just so thankful to be here. I started out as a fan in the crowd, and this place is amazing, regardless of where you're sitting," Newgarden said after pouring a bottle of whole milk over his head. "Everyone kept asking why I hadn't won this race, and they look at you like you're a failure if you haven't won it. I knew I was capable. I knew I could." Ericsson finished second in a Honda for Chip Ganassi Racing, and he immediately criticized IndyCar's decision to hold a one-lap shootout to the checkered flag. The Swede believed the race should have ended under caution, with him the winner, rather than having the green flag fly on the first lap out of the pits. "I think it was unfair and a dangerous way to end the race," Ericsson said. "I think I did everything right behind the wheel." Newgarden and Ericsson were followed by Santino Ferrucci, who gave 88-year-old A.J. Foyt his team's best finish in the iconic race that Super Tex won 4 times since Kenny Brock reached Victory Lane in 1999. Alex Palou, the pole sitter and race favorite for Chip Ganassi Racing, finished 4th after recovering from a crash on pit road, and Alexander Rossi was 5th on what was an otherwise disappointing day for Arrow McLaren. What was on pace to be the fastest Indy 500 in history ended with 3 red flags in the final 16 laps. The first came for a crash involving Felix Rosenquist and Kyle Kirkwood, who were near the front of the lead pack. Rosenquist touched the fence in turn one and could not prevent his Arrow McLaren car from sliding down the track. Kirkwood launched off his right rear tire and went upside down into the catch fence, beginning a terrifying spark-filled ride through the short chute. One of Kirkwood's wheels sailed over the fencing and narrowly cleared the packed grandstand. Nobody was injured. His tire smashed the hood of a Chevrolet in a parking lot next to the grandstand. All I know is I was up in the fence, which is never a good thing in IndyCar. Thank God these cars are so safe, Kirkwood said. I saw sparks flying everywhere. That's the scary part. You're upside down and you're kind of stuck at that point. On the restart, Pato O'Ward, who already had a restart called off for setting too slow of a pace, was shuffled from first to third as Newgarden shot to the lead. O'Ward and Erickson were then side by side entering turn three and touched wheels, and O'Ward slid into the wall and out of the race in another bitter disappointment for Aero McLaren. Agustin Canapino did a 360 spin behind him, snapping a brake line. He was unable to stop and collided with O'Ward's car. I was a little too nice there, O'Ward said. I just feel so bummed for the team. We had four very fast race cars. Now there's only two in the race. I got onto the apron to give Erickson room. I got squeezed. Yeah, I won't forget that. Suddenly, the race had its second red flag with six laps to go. Last year's race was red flagged with five to go when Erickson was leading O'Ward to the finish. Erickson held him off the rest of the way, and many criticized O'Ward for not making a more aggressive move for the win. Newgarden didn't make the same mistake with Erickson out in front of him. Marcus Erickson of Sweden. It's showing a picture of Marcus Erickson of Sweden making a pit stop during the Indianapolis 500 on Sunday at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in Indianapolis. Okay, I'm going to read the Eastern Iowa Briefs. First one is out of Cedar Rapids, African American Museum to break ground Wednesday. The African American Museum of Iowa will begin its building renovation project with a groundbreaking ceremony on Wednesday. The museum, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, is dedicated to preserving, exhibiting, and teaching Iowa's Black history. Last year, the museum launched its capital campaign, Voices Inspiring Progress. This campaign was prompted by the City of Cedar Rapids flood control system. In August 2022, the city began construction on a portion of the flood wall and gate system, which directly impacts the museum's facilities and operations. The museum used this as an opportunity to address other maintenance and capacity concerns. The building renovation will include interior and exterior updates designed to not only change the look of the building, but create sustainability and expand the museum's operational capacity, program delivery, and exhibit implementation. The project's general contractor, Point Builders, LLC, was selected through a publicly bid process, along with its design partner, Solem Lang Architects. The Voices Inspiring Progress campaign will fund this project and also aims to raise $1 million to support the museum's endowment. To date, the museum has raised more than $4.6 million toward its $6 million goal. Major contributions have come from the City of Cedar Rapids, $1,378,000, the Iowa Economic Development Authority, Destination Iowa, $800,000, and Enhance Iowa, CAT, $500,000, the Hall Perrine Foundation, $750,000, Linn County's American Rescue Plan Act, $333,000, along with many of the museum's long-standing business and community partners. The museum anticipates a grand reopening in February 2024. Out of Del Mar, The Voy 61 celebrates National Drive-In Movie Day Tuesday. The Voy 61 Drive-In Theater, located south of Maquoketa, will be having a special event to celebrate National Drive-In Movie Day on June 6th. Cost is $5 per vehicle, and the first 50 vehicles will receive a free Voy 61 drive-in frisbee. Before the movie, there will be a bounce house, face painting, petting zoo, and train rides. The movie will be Sing 2, which is rated PG. Gates will open at 6 p.m., and the movie will start at dusk at about 8:45 p.m. The Voy 61 drive-in theater at 1228 U.S. 61 is now in its 73rd year, and it is one of only four drive-ins still operating in Iowa. Patrons are welcome to bring a radio and lawn chair to watch the movie Under the Stars. The Voy 61 also has a swing set, sandbox, basketball court, wiffle ball diamond, tetherball, and volleyball. Guests are always welcome to bring their own food and tailgate before the movie. Okay, I'm going to end with a few things to do today. There's a Memorial Day service to honor military members who died in the line of duty. At this Memorial Day observation, it includes an opening prayer, live patriotic music, presentation of the colors, volley salute, and more. Guest speaker will be Dick Bell with Eastern Iowa Honor Flight. It's from 10 to 11 a.m. at the All Veterans Memorial Park, Veterans Memorial Drive Southwest, and Kurt Warner Boulevard Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Another Memorial Day service will feature keynote speaker Cecilia Rokosek, President and CEO of the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. It will also include the Czech Heritage Foundation Royal Court, live music, and refreshments. That's at 11 a.m. at the AVA Center, 2121 Bowling Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids. We also have Baby Animal Days. Visit the sweetest baby animals at Bloomsbury Farm. There will be baby goats, baby lambs, chicks, bunnies, ducklings, a calf, baby potbelly pigs, and more. From 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Bloomsbury Farm, 3260 69th Street in Atkins. The cost is $15.95. And then we have the 31st Annual Isle Renaissance Festival and Gathering O' Celts is $15.95. The Baby Animal Days is free. The annual celebration of European history and world culture also features stages of professional entertainment, games of skill, demonstrations, and exhibits, a food court, beer garden, and wine. Hands-on activities from 10 to 6, Middle Amana Community Park, 801 27th Avenue, Middle Amana. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.